Our third case for argument this morning is Ho against the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Ms. Matlaw.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Leslie Matlaw on behalf of Chuck Nan Fung. This case is before you today on review and for enforcement of HUD's final order below. There are three reasons why this court should decline to grant HUD's enforcement petition and remand to its Office of Administrative Law Judges to correct the errors below. First of all, in following HUD versus Wooten's two-step default process, Chief Judge Liberty gave respondents more due process than was required by the regulations. And the successor ALJ, Constance O'Brien, was obligated to strictly adhere to that process under the Accardi Doctrine, also set forth in Ramaprakash.
Could you explain why? You know, I can understand arguments based on law of the case or something like that, but adjudicative officers can modify law of the case. It's never a doctrine that applies in a higher court. If some litigant says, well, the district judge originally decided X. Think of our last case. The original district judge resigns and is replaced by a second district judge. The argument the second district judge didn't follow the first district judge's approach is neither here nor there when a case gets to the Court of Appeals. The question is whether the second district judge is right. Why isn't that exactly the same problem here? The second ALJ doesn't do what the first ALJ said. Who cares? The question is whether the second ALJ is right.
Well, the answer to your question is two-part. First of all, if an administrative agency provides additional process beyond what its requirements hold, then that agency is obligated to continue with all of that process. Otherwise, it violates the due process rights of the parties.
No, you're just repeating the proposition without any justification.
The doctrine
you're citing, Accardi, and there are many others, says that the agency can't change its position. The agency here is the Secretary of HUD, not a given administrative law judge. Has the Secretary of HUD ever said the right procedures to use are X and then failed to explain why he was using some different set of procedures?
Yes, in fact, Your Honor. The agency has in all of this is a default case, which is not subject to Rule 55 as it would be in federal court. Under the applicable procedures within the regulations of the Administrative Procedure Act and the Fair Housing Act itself, the agency may issue a default judgment. It is not required to issue a default judgment. But if it does so, it is obligated to follow that procedure. And, in addition, if you look at the body of law on default cases that have been issued by HUD's Office of Administrative Law Judges...
You're not following my question. Has the Secretary ever made this decision? All your brief cites is decisions of miscellaneous administrative law judges. They're all subordinate to the Secretary. Right? The kind of argument you're making is like saying, well, District Judge Smith reached decision X, and District Judge Jones didn't explain why he was departing from District Judge Smith's decision. That and 250 will get you a ride on the CTA. It's not important. If the district judge departed from a decision of this court or the Supreme Court, that would matter. When one district judge doesn't agree with another district judge, nothing happens. Well, an ALJ is pretty much, you know, it's the line trial officer. I'm asking, has the secretary done something? Not has one or another rogue ALJ done something?
No. The secretary has not ruled as far as what is the appropriate and applicable default procedure.
All right. So the question as a matter of administrative law is, does a decision of one administrative law judge that is not adopted by the agency, take an ALJ in under the National Labor Relations Act. It's under the Labor Board. Labor Board's got hundreds of ALJs. They make decisions. Many of them are never reviewed by the National Labor Relations Board. Is there any decision that says one ALJ's decision binds another ALJ? Because I'm not aware of any such decision.
Well,
if you are, I need to know it.
That would be Rama Prakash, Your Honor.
Pardon?
And that would be Rama Prakash, Your Honor, the case that I cited to that basically comes out of the Accardi Doctrine and the three red-baiting cases of the 50s. The problem in this instance was
that was a case in which one ALJ was required to explain his decision not from the agency depart, but from another ALJ?
Rama Prakash was an instance where the National Labor Relations Board extended the process that was already available under the agency's process to provide more due process to respondents, to protect respondents' rights from government overreach.
Could you address my question? My question is there some case out there holding that a decision of one ALJ, not reviewed by the agency or the secretary, binds another ALJ? That's my question.
Well, the Wooten case was...
Well, which case?
That was HUD versus Wooten, which was the case that was the applicable precedent that had been used immediately prior.
I wish you'd just address my question.
Your Honor, in this particular instance, the chief administrative law judge said, the government, a default judgment against each respondent...
Well, a decision of a chief U.S. district judge counts for no more than the decision of some other district judge. I'm not asking you to cite me the case by ALJ number one, who you think is binding on ALJ number two. I'm asking you to cite me a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States or a United States Court of Appeals that the Accardi principle applies when the agency itself, when the secretary or the National Labor Relations Board has never made a decision, but all one points to is two contrasting or conflicting decisions of administrative law judges. Is there such a case? That's the critical question.
To my knowledge, the operative case that, to which would most closely apply would be Vitarelli v. Seaton, which is all under the umbrella of the Accardi Doctrine. But in this particular case, this was a default case where, upon looking at the well-pled allegations of the government's charge of discrimination, the judge reviewing that charge required the government to prove up prima facie liability, notwithstanding that respondents had defaulted. That judge said, okay, we're going to hold a hearing on damages and liability, but I'm still requiring you, Mr. Government, to prove up your prima facie case in order to establish that liability is present. In the second decision that the subsequent ALJ issued, she leapfrogged at the request of government counsel over that protection for respondents' due process rights as to whether or not the government even had a case under any of the applicable violations alleged, and at the government's request said, no, we're going to dispense with liability. We're going to move right along onto damages. And in issuing that order, that second ALJ did not conform to the regulations in terms of how much time was provided to respond to even respond to the government's motion to modify that order. There's a problem there from the standpoint, and that's why I cite to the Accardi Doctrine. There's a problem there as far as fundamental due process is concerned. The second reason why this court should decline to enforce and should remand below is that in that second decision, the ALJ, second ALJ, failed to examine her jurisdiction over the case. And the government's charge of discrimination on its face demonstrated that jurisdiction was lacking. That is an error that is never harmless. It cannot be waived. Finally, if this court upholds the decision below, it will set binding precedent, which is applicable to administrative agencies across the board, state, local and federal, in an important area of first impression, which is whether and to what extent a federal statute's prohibitions against discrimination can trump individuals' First Amendment speech and associational rights, where those preferences not only concerned a shared intimate space, but were never expressed to the home seeker here by either respondent. I'm in rebuttal already. I will reserve my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Wang, appearing on behalf of the Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I'm going to spend my time focusing on the propriety of the ALJ's entry of a default judgment without a hearing, while Mr. Ortiz will address the statutory exemptions claimed by Fong. I'll, of course, answer any questions the panel may have. ALJ O'Brien's order, which entered a default judgment of liability and reserved...
I hope sometime or other, not necessarily now, you'll get to the question of damages, which even in a default proceeding have to be established.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because here seem to have been picked out of a hat.
Your Honor, if you'd like, I can address the damages issue.
In whatever order you wish, but I do want you to get to it sometime.
Yes, Your Honor. The ALJ O'Brien's order complied with the applicable regulation and HUD and circuit precedent. It did not represent the change in agency course. The plain language of 24 CFR 180.420 subsection B mandates admission of all factual allegations in the charge of discrimination and gives the ALJ discretion to enter a default judgment in response to a party's failure to answer a charge. This regulation gives wide discretion to an ALJ to enter a default judgment. It does not mandate the ALJ issue an order to show cause before defaulting the respondent, does not require the ALJ to hold a hearing on liability, and does not require extensive discussion of liability in the initial decision. In response to the charging party's motion for modification, ALJ O'Brien acted well within her discretion in issuing an order limiting the hearing to damages. The facts of the charge admitted by the non-response of Ho and Fung established the prima facie case. The witnesses had to travel long distances for unnecessary and redundant testimony, and the respondents completely thumbed their nose at the entire process. They didn't respond to the charge, didn't respond to the default motion, Fung did not show up for the hearing, and Ho did not seek a lawyer until the last minute, despite being told months in advance that a lawyer would be needed. Indeed, in many of the cases Fung cites in his reply brief, the ALJ entered a default judgment and limited the hearing to damages, indicating what ALJ O'Brien did in this case was the normal course of action, not an unexplained procedural departure. Rama Prakash, which counsel for Fung cited in her opening argument, is readily distinguishable because in that case, the NTSB cited rationales that it had specifically considered and rejected in earlier decisions. In this case, you don't have a specific holding of the secretary stating that a specific hearing on liability is required in order to enter a default judgment on liability. Fung's reliance on Wooten for the proposition that an ALJ is required to hold a hearing on liability is misplaced. In that case, the ALJ merely exercised the discretion the applicable regulation afforded him to enter a default judgment in deciding not to enter a default judgment before holding a hearing. In Wooten, moreover, the hearing on liability was warranted to determine whether the ambiguous statements in the record were discriminatory, and the ALJ concluded they were not. In this case, by contrast, the admitted factual allegations in the charge sufficed on their face to establish the violations of the Fair Housing Act. The ALJ also acted consistently with circuit precedents cited in Wooten, which merely reiterates well-established legal propositions that upon default, well-pleaded allegations of the complaint relating to liability are taken as true, and the default judgment establishes as a matter of law that defendants are liable to plaintiff as to each cause of action. Because the ALJ did not arbitrarily depart from precedent, and precluding Ho and Fung from contesting liability, a remand to HUD for reconsideration is unwarranted.
Is there any relevant precedent? Has the Secretary ever addressed this question? I know you point to the regulation. But now and again, one would expect the Secretary would actually make his own decision in one of these proceedings. Has the Secretary done so?
To my knowledge, the Secretary has not done so. Basically, he's left the process up to the individual ALJs. Some ALJs have decided to, such as ALJ Andretta, have issued orders to show cause before entering a default judgment. ALJ O'Brien has not done so in her usual course.
The Secretary had promulgated a regulation saying, in dealing with default judgments, ALAs shall just make up their mind as they go along and pay no attention whatsoever to any governing principles. Wouldn't one suspect that that's, well, putting legality to one side, irresponsible?
Your Honor, in that specific instance, I do agree there would be a certain problem with that specific...
That's what counsel says the Secretary has effectively done. It's just for an extended period, this statute was, after all, enacted 45 years ago, permitted ALJs to go their own way, disagree with one another, made no effort to produce uniform agency policy. Is that troubling?
No, Your Honor. I think what the Secretary has done has given each ALJ discretion, and if the ALJ's decision does not have a rational basis, that is a ground for overturning the ALJ's decision. But the whole idea of giving the ALJ discretion is the ALJ is the individual who's most familiar with the record and can enter a decision that's most consistent with what's inside the record. So in this particular case, you have a case of two respondents who absolutely failed to do anything when served with a charge in the motion for default, and the ALJ quite reasonably decided to enter a default judgment against them, considering their non-response and the fact of the charge establishing the prima facie case. I'll now turn to Judge Easterbrook, Chief Judge Easterbrook's question about the damages. Damages did not constitute an abuse of discretion. The ALJ took testimony from both interveners, Ms. Bracken and Ms. Lynn, and indicating the severe detrimental effects that the violations of the Fair Housing Act had on these particular individuals. In her decision, she cited several ALJ decisions ordering damages of comparable amounts in setting the damages awarded to each respondent.
Well, what about ability to pay? How is that taken into account here?
Your Honor,
the maximum civil penalty is $11,000, and I would think that's reserved for, you know, a defendant who has the wherewithal to pay that kind of money.
Your Honor, the legislative history indicates that there's five different factors that a court, that an ALJ uses to determine the civil penalty, and the ALJ in this specific...
You know what legislative history counts for these days.
Your Honor, we're just basically what...
sell the paper in which the legislative history appears and presumably get a positive price.
Your Honor, I realize legislative history does have certain limitations, but that's what a lot of ALJs in awarding civil penalties have followed, so that's the best indication of what the proper procedure to follow in this particular case was. And
there's an enormous difference between rules of law and statements of legislative preference, and legislative history is a statement of legislative preference. Are there any rules of law applicable here?
Rules of law, no, Your Honor. Basically, again, it's committed to the discretion of the ALJ, and that's the one guidance that we have.
It can't be. Yeah. You know, determining damages is very hard, but if this were a suit in federal court, we would not say that damages are, quote, committed to the district judge's discretion. We would say the district judge had to have some reason for choosing damages, some means of estimating loss, for example. Now, it may be very difficult, right? There are all sorts of categories of damages, pain and suffering, hedonic damages, and so on, that are very hard to quantify. But we don't say the district judge is entitled just to pick a number in its discretion, and it's unreviewable. That's what's troubling here.
Your Honor, that's why we believe that the five factors that the ALJ applied did cabin her discretion to a certain extent, and that's the best that we could come up with, that the ALJs have been able to come up with in terms of determining what damages are to be awarded. It's not totally basically picking a number out of a hat. I think that she properly applied those factors and determined that given the nature of the violation and the non-responsiveness of the respondents, that the maximum civil penalty in this particular case was warranted. I see that my time is limited, so if the panel has any additional questions, I'd like to answer them at this point.
Silence is thundering.
Your Honor, I'd just like to, before my time is officially up, just point out that the substantial evidence supports the findings that both Ho violated the Fair Housing Act.
You think you're constitutionally required to run out your time by talking, but you aren't. You've got nothing to say. The thing to do is to shut up, but there you are. You'll run it out.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I respectfully request this Court deny the petition for review and grant the Secretary's cross-application for enforcement of HUD's final order. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ortiz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Damian Ortiz from the John Marshall Law School on behalf of Mackie Bracken, who was denied the opportunity to sublease a rental unit on the basis of her that she was black, on the basis of her race, and Diana Lynn, who was interfered with and intimidated, retaliated against for assisting Mackie Bracken for enforcing her fair housing rights on violation of 3617, 3604 A and C. Your Honors, this case is based solely on the affirmative decision of the petitioners not to participate in the process. That's what the problem is here, Your Honor. Non-participation in the process is what led us to this court today. There is no dispute that the petitioners received all the notices that were sent by the parties involved and the ALJ to the petitioners, and they failed to avail themselves of the process. And this court in Wanko versus Canaan Associates at 965 F. Second 565 held that a judgment that stems from a party's own willful failure to avail themselves of its opportunity to be heard does not constitute a violation of due process. And the ALJ below, default judgment and liability and assessment of the damages was within its normal course of action. And this court's requirements when a default judgment is entered pursuant to United States versus DiMucci, Merrill Lynch, and Dundee Cement Company. A defaulted party must come with an exceptional circumstance in order for this court to set aside the default judgment. We have no exceptional circumstances, Your Honor. Also in Jones versus Phipps, this court indicated that a defaulted party must show an existence of a meritorious defense, which they do not have. They allege an exception that applies an exemption to this case. However, Your Honor, 3603B does not apply to this case for one reason, and that's the Supreme Court in Mills Music versus Snyder, 469 U.S. 153, stated that under general principles of statutory construction, one who claims the benefit of an exception must come forward and has the burden of proving that that exception applies. Obviously here, they have not met that burden. But furthermore, Your Honors, the petitioners cite to Hutt versus Gusdatis, a 1998 Westlaw 482759 decision of the agency. And in that case, they wrongfully apply and suggest that the ALJ, sua sponte, has a statutory exemption under the decision of Gusdatis. However, this court, under E360 Insight versus the Spam House Project, 500 F3rd 594, clearly held that a court or a judge is not required to sua sponte raise affirmative defenses of liability for a party that does not participate in the process or does not elect to raise their own defenses. Here, and additionally, Your Honor, those exemptions were waived. Those exemptions under 18420, subsection A2 of the regulation, clearly states that an answer should include any affirmative defenses. Here, we don't even have an answer to the complaint. Additionally, under the statute 3612K3, any objections not raised below to the ALJ are waived, and this court cannot review those questions. But furthermore, Your Honors, even if this court finds that the ALJ should have sua sponte raised those exemptions for a party that does not participate in the process, it is a fact, an undisputed fact, that the landlord, the intervening petitioner, is in the business of renting property. And under 3603C, that fact alone takes away any opportunity or any question that the exemption applies. Why the cross-application should be enforced, Your Honors? The charge, the complaint, and the admissions of the petitioners and the evidence presented at the hearing and the award of damages that the ALJ held were reasonable. And the decision is well-reasoned, in fact, and in law, and it gives this court sufficient detail and clarity to make a determination that the Fair Housing Act was violated and that the damages were reasonable. But most importantly, Your Honors, the decision below is supported by substantial evidence in accordance with the...
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Therefore, we ask that to enforce the cross-application.
Anything further, Ms. Lantlaw?
I'd just like to respond briefly to some of the assertions that were made by opposing counsel here. First of all, it is incumbent upon every court to examine its jurisdiction. And that was never done here, nor were there any reasons given or any factual findings as to liability. It is still incumbent upon the government to prove its prima facie case and that violations of the Act did, in fact, occur. And that is why Grudzaitis is instructive in this regard. In Grudzaitis, the judge saw from the complaint that the well-pled allegations of the government's charge were insufficient standing alone to establish liability, just as in this case. They proved some of it. They didn't prove all of it. And that was why Chief Judge Liberty said, show me what you've got. Moreover, I wanted to respond to Mr. Ortiz's claim that the respondents did not answer. Under HUD's regulations, respondents are not required to answer. They may answer. But as far as receiving all of the process to which they were due and they received all of the notices, they did not receive the order telling them that the government had been relieved of its duty to prove up the prima facie case and the fact that there were actual violations here. What we have in this instance is a situation where the property was exempt, where the statements that were made – I'd like, if I may, suggest that the court – bear in mind that the property in this question, in this case, is a one-bedroom apartment in which drywall had been inserted into the living room common area so that three women could share a bathroom and a kitchen. There was nothing to establish that there were the requisite number of properties owned by Mr. Fung, and there has never been a case that has held that. That in this particular fact pattern, where you have three
separate there were three separate bedrooms, but a shared kitchen and bath. Is that wrong?
There was one bedroom which was closable by a door. A drywall barrier had been constructed in.
Oh, were there three bedrooms that were made here?
There were three sleeping areas. I wouldn't feel comfortable with calling them bedrooms because the intimate space was not sufficiently bounded. But even so, from the face of the complaint, it is apparent that the government's own complaint only alleges that there were three units. It requires four. From the face of the complaint, the as recognized by Chief Judge Liberty, there was not enough to establish a violation of the Act. There's no jurisdiction here. The other part of, and I refer to Judge Easterbrook's questions as to whether or not the facts were sufficient to establish damages. The facts were also lacking with regard to liability. There were never any adjudicated facts with regard to liability. That was that shortcut procedure that they went through. First, you're required to prove the prima facie case and liability. Oh, well, never mind about that. And that order was served by regular mail 6 days before the hearing, when the regulations provide 7. These particular respondents did not have fax machines. Everything had been served by Federal Express. There was a great deal of effort made in order to ensure that these respondents received proper notice, both by government counsel and by the ALJs previously. It's particularly telling that this ALJ, in fundamentally changing the rules in the middle of the game as far as what the respondents would be required to answer to, did not permit respondents to have the opportunity. They still had the opportunity, notwithstanding that they couldn't put evidence forth. They still had the opportunity to, at the close of the evidence, file their brief and say, look, the government simply hasn't proven its case. And that opportunity was foreclosed to them by virtue of Judge O'Brien's later modifying order, which failed to comply with the well-established Accardi doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.